Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
In the writings that are extant, what is called primitive Buddhism, that is, it was the Buddhism that was presented by the Buddha himself rather than 500 years later of what was put onto it. Here, there we find this. The Buddha said, when a man makes utensils out of a metal which has been thoroughly cleansed of dross, the utensils will be excellent. You monks who wish to follow the way, make your own hearts clean from the dirt of passions, and your conduct will be unimpeachable. Even if one escapes from the creations of passions, it is one's rare fortune to be born a human being. If one be born a man, it is one's rare fortune to be perfect in all the six senses. Even if he be perfect in all the six senses, it is rare fortune to be born in the time of a Buddha. Even if he be born in the time of a Buddha, it is his rare fortune to see the enlightened. Even if he is able to see the enlightened, it is his rare fortune to have his heart awakened in faith. Even if he have faith, it is his rare fortune to awaken the heart of intelligence. Even if he awaken the heart of intelligence, it is his rare fortune to realize a spiritual state which is above discipline and attainment. O child of Buddha, you are away from me so many thousand miles, but if you remember and think of my precepts, you shall surely gain the fruit of enlightenment. You may, standing by my side, see me always, but if you observe not my precepts, you shall never gain enlightenment. Of course, we know that the precepts that the Buddha gave, which every religious tradition has, there are many levels of understanding them. But in the Eastern traditions, you know, in India, and of course in Buddhism, because it is out of India, there is this ocean wave theory, where the mind is compared to an ocean with waves. That is, we think. Therefore, we have waves in this ocean of mind. And now, without waves, what? When you don't think, what is? Well, we'll say the mind, but let us this morning say the soul. When you're not thinking, soul is present, huh? And the difference between the ocean with the waves and this silent ocean with no waves is, you know, is turmoil. That's the difference. Thinking, you know, is this soul disturbed. Or soul is silent mind. The mind is not something separate from the soul, as waves are not separate from the water. The water of a lake can be perfectly placid and have no waves, but the waves cannot be without the water. A soul can be without a thinking mind, but the mind cannot be without the soul. You know, when there are great winds, then sometimes we know them as great winds and sometimes they're just little breezes. But great winds, you know, we have emotional and mental turmoil and the water is disturbed. What is it right now? When the water is disturbed, the lake, this very placid lake, loses a quality. The quality of reflection. Choppy water does not reflect it as it is. It reflects choppy. It reflects distortion. You know of yourself that when you are in a turmoil and you're trying to arrive at a point of this is what I must do about the situation, because of the turmoil, it is very difficult to see what the situation even is. You've got all of your things put into it, and so you drag out this one little thing and say, well, this is the situation. And that's not true at all. It's just all chopped up in there together. It's distorted. We have a very distorted picture. You know, it's like the moon when it's reflected in the water. In choppy water, well, it's fragmented, or we've got many moons. Every wave has got a moon. You know, and that's not true. It's distorted. One moon, not millions of moons. No. You begin to think, and moon here, and moon there, and moon here, and moon there, moon everywhere, And you know it can't be true. Of course, at that moment, probably you don't pay any attention to it. True or not true, you're just in this turmoil, going around like an egg beater. When the mind reflects clearly, there's one moon. There's one. One mind. When the thinking enters, there's many. And you should see this in yourself. So, therefore, the old Zen koan, you know, the many comes from the one. To what does the one return? Now, mind, or consciousness, this consciousness all by itself, consciousness. Consciousness does not know discrimination. Consciousness does not know the discrimination of religious sects. See, that's many. Consciousness is one. If you think that I belong to such and such a thing, even to this, and everything else is, you know, it is a distorted view. True religion is religion. It is a heartfelt thing, and it is one. We all carry, let us say, this essence of God, essence of Buddha. That essence is religion, and it does not belong to this, that, or the other. It is what it is. So let the mind settle into this essence. So there's no waves. There is simply consciousness, and there is no conditioning attached to it. And then it is said, it is one. And we may be many, but it is one. Or as they say in the East, it is non-dual. It is not two. Now, what winds blow on the consciousness, on this mind, to disturb it? What winds blow? Well, I think we all know the winds that blow. But Buddha says the name of that wind is passion. The name of that wind is desire. And if you will observe yourself, you can see this. You will see that these winds have nothing to do with any theory. It is your desire about the theory. It has nothing to do with theory. The mind is not formulating a great philosophy, or it is not wallowing around in metaphysics. No. So the Buddha's approach was simply to say something so that you could experience immediately. You experience will prove to you his words. And there's no other way to prove it. Whatever he said, you may mentally, the waves may, get in there and say that's correct, that's incorrect. To experience in that placid lake, that still water, and experience without any words, without any concepts, without any thought, immediate. It ends all debating and it ends all arguments. The experience does. So for us here who sit, experience is the name of the game, isn't it? You're sitting very silently, letting all the waves subside. No winds blowing. Not moving into the future. Not trying to drag up the past, so that the future can be better. No matter how enticing, just sitting silently, content with the now, with this moment. And in that moment, if you are silent, you will see what the Buddha meant. Now, in a way, we could say that desire is a kind of attention. It's like we're trying to, improve on the past with the future. So there's a tension between past and future. And, of course, because we're not in the present, actually, we're thinking we're in the present, but being in the present. So we have this tension and just a very little flicker of it, and the whole lake is disturbed. And we've been taught here in this country, in our culture, to cultivate character, be a good character, have good character. Buddha says, cultivate consciousness. Consciousness is character, or consciousness is characterless. And we've been told, be good, Be good, little boys and girls, huh? Be good. Buddha says just be silent and good will be done. The good follows silence, you know, just as your shadow follows you. So cultivate consciousness. Being rather than doing. You know, with every child that comes into this world, there's bound to be some conflict between the child and its parents. In the beginning, it's particularly the mother, because it's the mother that the child clings to, and it's the mother that it depends upon. And later on, it has conflict with the father. And this is quite natural. Of course, now with the mother, she has her own ways of doing things. She has her own ideas. She has her philosophy of life and how life should be lived. And here's this child. Sometimes, you know, children have a great deal of energy. Sometimes they're almost wild with energy. And the child, the little, you know, he doesn't know anything about society. Society is something he's going to have to learn. He doesn't know anything about our culture. He doesn't know anything about our religions. You know, you name it, he doesn't know it. You know, he's just come from God. He has nothing but freedom, this energy. So now there's bound to be some conflict. The child has to be initiated into the ways of society. He must, or he's not going to survive. He just can't be left alone to mature willy-nilly. He has to be taught something. So this conflict is very natural. All of that energy that he has is to be harnessed, so that he can use it for whatever. Now, if the mother is a very good mother, the child has a little difficulty. There is some anxiety there. The anxiety evolves around that the child loves its freedom. And he knows, as we all instinctively know, we all intrinsically know, that freedom is good. Freedom has an intrinsic value to it. We all want it. Everyone is born with this desire for freedom. And total freedom, of course, the ultimate moksha, wherein the individual is completely fulfilled and has no limitations. He's called absolutely free. That is the inner world. But he doesn't run wild with this freedom. No. He knows the ways of society, of the culture, and the energy flows through that. The freedom flows through that. But this child, you know, born with this intrinsic desire to be free, and here, what does he find? This bondage, you know. Everyone says, particularly Mama, she says, don't do that. Don't do this. Don't sit there. Don't go there. Don't. Whatever you do, don't, you know. And the poor child feels all pushed and pulled around. Now, if this is what we should say, you can't call her a bad mother, but an irresponsible mother, a sorry mother. The difficulty then the child has is that he hates her. That's simple as 1, 2, 3. She destroys his freedom and he hates her. Maybe he can't express it, but he knows she's the rottenest woman in the world. He may pay lip service, but it is not a good state of affairs. If the mother is a good mother, then we have another problem. The child is all at a loss to figure this out. The mother is good. Freedom is good. If mother is good, I must be wrong. My freedom must be wrong. If I'm good and my freedom is good, then mother must be wrong. But to think that the mother is wrong, that's impossible. How can I think that about my mother? Because she's really good. You know, she's caring and she's loving and she's doing 1,001 things for me. The mother's really good and the child knows it. You know? The only solution that the child has to such a dilemma is, I must be wrong. Once the child begins to think, I must be wrong, he begins to reject himself. How now can you accept yourself if you reject yourself? Growth in maturing is a coming together. It's an integration. You can't reject and accept at the same time, so there's this split. And it kind of hangs around the neck, you know, like a burden. There's always this tension there. And you can't throw it away because it's part of you. The best you can do is maybe throw it in the subconscious for a while, you know, and become unaware of it. You know, forget about it, just as if it weren't there. Most people do this. The subconscious has got a lot of these things in it, you know, ones we don't want to look at too closely. But eventually, look, we must. And sitting silently, we do. You know? One by one, these dead fish rise. And now, because we've been sitting, everybody, most people know that I mean for meditation, sitting for meditation, we can deal with them now from a mature point of view. We have matured somewhat. We're growing up, finally. And what the child could not deal with, mature men and women can. Yeah. To feel good about oneself should be a natural and an easy thing. Feel good about yourself. Really, feel good about yourself. All of this rejection business, you know, is just something that you've gone out and picked, you know, like you've gone out and picked strawberries. Yeah. Either ingest them, assimilate them, get rid of them that way, or take them back out to the field. You know, it's like anything. If somebody gives you a present and you don't accept it, to whom does the present belong? It's not yours. Now, this, what we are told, you know, do good. Go out there and do good. The way to be good, be good, has nothing to do with a little goody two shoes that we learned, you know, Rebecca at Sunnybrook Farm, you know. Being good has to do with centering oneself, to center oneself with awareness. And so in this centering, this awareness, then we could say, you know, that a good person is characterless. That is, he has not all of this defense mechanism, and not all of this armor put up here. He's just simply open. He's neither good nor bad. He's open. It's simply here, just alert and conscious and responsible. By responsible, he responds to this moment, to this that is happening now, without dragging the past into this or trying to bring the future into this. It is just this alertness. It's responding from now. Character, as we usually look at it, means that we've got to go on carrying the things that we've learned in the past. You know, it's our conscience. The content of the psyche. That's our character, usually. All the things that we have learned of do this and don't do this. And right? Now, when the psyche is unconditioned, when there are no conditions in it, when there are no conditions involved whatsoever, we could say it's characterless. Hmm? And you're not burdened by this. You don't need to care for it. You don't need to polish its shoes, you know, and take it out at night and hang it up and say, be good until tomorrow. You can even forget it, you know. It's going to be with you. You're not going to lose it. Character, huh? It's real only when you can't lose it. If you're afraid that if you do something, you might lose your good character, then it's not consciousness. It's not centered. It's something you have learned. So in everything that you do, let consciousness be present. Let consciousness be present in everything you do. You know, Gurdjieff, he used to, I think everybody has heard about him. He was a Russian, and he had a school in France, finally. He was in London for a while, and then he moved to France. And he taught dancing, along with all these other things. And with his dancing, he had a method. And it was called the stop method. He taught, you know, this, it's really very beautiful, it's symbolical, you express yourself in this dance, huh? And you would be dancing along, and all of a sudden he would say, stop! And no matter where you were in this dance, that's what you did, you stopped. And you would have to hold that until he said, okay. But you know, it's stop! Sokian, Dr. Plathoff's teacher, had a favorite koan. You know, on the Great Lake, there's a great lake out there, and on that lake there's a sailing boat. Stop the boat. Yeah. Walking down a road with a jerk, just stop. You know? Just a split second. I mean, it's a split second, you know. There isn't very much time in there, so you've got to be very alert. Just remain unmoving. If you stop slowly, the mind is going to wind right down. It adjusts itself very readily, you know. Huh? But if suddenly you stop, it's like when the clackers go sometimes. Suddenly there's a stop. Hmm? In that shock, the mind stops. And in that split second of stopping, you will see that the whole world has stopped. Because all the waves have disappeared. If you're dancing, suddenly stop. If you're running, suddenly stop. If you're swimming, suddenly stop. But then start swimming again, otherwise you'll sink. Right? But if you're talking, suddenly stop. In that stop, you know, just be absolutely unmoving. Be like a statue. Your mind, too, as if it were frozen. Because the waves will take possession of you again almost immediately. Just, But in that little moment, that first stop, you know, you will have a glimpse of that silence. And having a glimpse, it will become a tremendous support for you. It's always something you can lean on. Now, Buddha says, When a man makes utensils out of a metal which has been thoroughly cleaned, the utensils will be excellent. You monks who wish to follow the way, make your own hearts clean and your conduct will be unimpeachable. At the very center of all of us, there is this silent emptiness, for lack of a better word. We are silent and we are empty. That core That silence has never been involved in our doings. Not in our thinkings and not in our desirings. We, of course, have the desires and the thinkings and the feelings and the doings, and it is present, but it is not involved. It's a witness. By its very nature, it remains pure and uncontaminated. Now, you don't have to believe me. You can prove whether or not, to use Jackson's phrase, I speak with a forked tongue. Whether or not, You can prove. You can prove anything right or wrong. And I ask you to try it. After all, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, isn't it? Prove it. When you were a child, you were as a child, like all children are, And now you're no longer a child. Bodily, anyway. When you are young, you are as you are young. Now maybe some of us are no longer so young. The childhood body is gone. And the childhood mind has gone, we hope. We had another body in the youth, and that's gone, and with it the vigor and the vitality of youth. It's not quite so vital, so vigorous as it once was. In youth there is ambition and drive and desires and ego. Now maybe it's a little mellowed out. And then down the line, older, then we begin, death is coming. And maybe we can even hear the sound of it. Now we can think such things. But observe, in all the changes that you've gone through, all the emotional turmoil that you have gone through, you've remained the same. When you were a child, the same consciousness watching. You were young, the same consciousness watching. And when the time comes when you get old, the same consciousness watching. You don't change. Only the content. It's all just conditioning. Consciousness also, we say, is like a mirror. Child stands before a mirror, and the mirror reflects the child. The young man stands before the mirror, and the mirror reflects a young man or a young woman. An old man or an old woman stands before the mirror, and the mirror reflects the old man or the old woman. The mirror is neither the child, nor is it young, nor is it old. And when all conditions, when all these changes have been met and dealt with and they're gone, they're simply the mirror reflecting. Just being present. Consciousness like a mirror. You know, and this metaphor, this attitude of this mirror-like consciousness, is very meaningful, and it can be very helpful if you understand it. Of course, to understand it, you must see it. Instead of always identifying with the reflections in the mirror, we can, with some effort, identify with this mirror itself. You know, Shakespeare said, life is a stage. Yeah. It's a great drama, and it's very complex. First of all, you're the actor. You're the director. You're the film. You're the screen. You're the projector. And you are the audience. Very complex, huh? Transcending, or we could say behind the scenes, transcending all of this, you know, is the witness. Simply watching. This mirror is never contaminated. You can put a heap of manure in front of it. Of course, it's going to reflect it. But the mirror isn't touched. Remove the manure, and the mirror is present in all its purity, as it has always been. If you cleanse your heart, the Buddha said, your conduct will be unimpeachable, coming from that mirror. Your conduct will be unimpeachable. So the emphasis is not on the conduct, but on the mirror-like purity of consciousness, of the mind, huh? There's where you do from. There's where you be from. Even if one escapes from the desire creations, it is one's rare fortune to be born a human being. Now, the Tibetans, as you all probably know, have 28 categories of precepts. There are 10 causes of regret. There are 10 requirements. There are the 10 things to be done. There are the 10 things to be avoided. There are the 10 things one must know. There are the 10 things to be practiced. There are the 10 errors. There are the 13 grievous failures. And on and on and on and on, all these 28 categories. But all of these begin with the devotee seeking liberation and omniscience of Buddhahood should first meditate upon these 10 things which are the causes of regret. 1. Having obtained the difficult to obtain free and endowed human body, it would be a cause of regret to fritter life away. 2. It is a rare fortune to be born as a human being, says Buddha. As a human being, you have an opportunity. You have the opportunity to wake up. And now it is said that nature sleeps. The rocks sleep, the plants are sleeping, maybe a little more awake. They're sleeping. Man is dreaming. But if you're dreaming, you know, it means you're not fast asleep. You're not sound asleep. A rare blessing. And if you make the opportunity, If you make the effort to use this opportunity, you can wake up. Don't miss it. It would be ridiculous to waste your opportunity. You know, there are those who, if you say to them, you know, meditation really is quite a wonderful thing to do. And the answer that you get, of course, is, but where's the time? I don't have any time to meditate. You know, it takes time. We just don't have the time. And then maybe the next few days later, you see them, and they're out playing cards at the club, or they're playing out on the golf course, and you ask them, what are you doing? And they'll say, I'm killing time. So are you killing time, or is time killing you? No. Time to sit there is. You make it. Even if one be born a man, it is one's rare fortune to be perfect in all six senses. The first blessing you're born, and the second blessing you were born with six senses. You know, the sixth one is the mind. So one now becomes very alert about these senses. What are they reporting, and what are you doing with what they report? You learn about this sense life. It's your opportunity. Even if one be perfect in all the six senses, it is his rare fortune to be born in the time of a Buddha. Well, of course, we weren't. But in the presence of a Buddha, meditation is very easy. You know, you don't have to struggle with it. Ramakrishna used to say, when the wind is blowing in the right direction, you simply leave your boat in the stream and the wind takes it. Huh? That's how easy it is. You just be in the right time, at the right place, and there you go, folks. Yeah. Even if he be born in the time of a Buddha, it is his rare fortune to see the enlightened. Well, you know, if someone were, say a Buddha were born and he walked in here, not necessarily here, but somewhere, and we're urging people to look at themselves, to be with themselves, to cope with themselves, you know. And the person decided against it and never went to see him, never heard what he had to say. You know, they miss it. They missed it all. And we would have all of our interpretations as to why we didn't do that. Well, we'll skip it. Well, I really should, but you know, I've got to do this over here, and I've got to do that over there. This is important. That's not so important. I'll do it when I'm old. We usually save it for when, you know, somebody once said religion is for old people. But our interpretations, you know, again, it's an interpretation. Religion is for the young. They're not so conditioned out of it. It's like this, you know, our monk, we dump all kinds of things on him, but our monk, he came home one night and he found his wife in the arms of another man. And this man fast talked him into going out and having a cup of coffee. And it happened again the next night, and the next night, and the next night. And finally he went to the doctor. And he told him he was very worried. And he explained the situation, you know. 5 nights, exactly the same thing. This man is there, I go out with him and have coffee. And the doctor says, my good man, you don't need a doctor, you need a lawyer. No, 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 said the monk. I want a doctor. I've got to know if I'm drinking too much coffee. You see, let's not disturb, let's not rock the boat. These are our interpretations. You don't like that, Willie?
Oh, boy. I love it.
No, you don't. You shook your head. Well, we do things like that. We do. Even if he be able to see the enlightened, it is his rare fortune to have his heart awakened in faith. You know, if one's heart is awakened, all of a sudden this trust rises. And when trust is present, you know, you have faith, which is very different than belief. Faith isn't based on anything that's logical. You can't destroy faith because it is illogical. Faith is like falling in love. It doesn't need a reason and it doesn't need a cause. It's faith. Even if he have faith, it is his rare fortune to awaken the heart of intelligence. You know, this is what the Buddha says. When your heart is full of love and full of faith and full of trust, this is not yet the end. There is a tremendous intelligence to experience. To awaken the heart of intelligence. What is at the heart of intelligence? See, what is at the heart of love? Faith is a door by which you enter. But just don't stand at the door. Have faith in your own enlightenment. But work to make it real. The seed must fall into the earth. It must be born as a sprout. Even through 1,001 difficulties. And difficulties you will have. There's the wind and there's the thunder and there's the rain and there's the burning sun. It needs a gardener. When you choose a teacher, you choose a gardener. Even if he awakens the heart of intelligence, it is his rare fortune to realize a spiritual state which is above discipline and attainment. There is something above attainment. That's non-attainment, Yeah. Discipline is extremely important. We discipline ourselves to sit. We discipline ourselves to stop. We discipline ourselves to always be conscious of consciousness, to be aware of it, People come and go. I see people come and go, come and go. They come and go willy-nilly, and they're doing their own thing. That's fine, you know. But they say they are in earnest, and they say they want attainment. One must discipline oneself. Only in this discipline of oneself can you come to a point where discipline can be dropped. To understand this discipline of transcendence, it's what's called the seventh fortune, the ultimate, To be born a human being is the beginning. It's the beginning of all good things. O child of Buddha, you are away from me ever so many thousands of miles. But if you remember and think of my precepts, you shall surely gain the fruit of enlightenment. You may, standing by my side, see me always. To be alert, to be aware that the witness is witnessing, it is present always. to stand by my side, to have all of these conditions standing right next to the unconditioned, huh? So that they can gradually diminish. Then you come home. You come home to yourself. Just don't stay 1,000 miles away. You come home so that you know the meaning and the significance and the grandeur of being awake, standing by his side. And now may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.